Welcome to Wabanaki Windows. I'm Donna Loring. Today's program is a tribute, one that will take 2 full hours over 2 shows to honor the life of Charles Norman Shea, a Penobscot elder, World War II combat veteran, and a man whose life carried the weight of history. Charles was a survivor of D-Day at Omaha Beach. He witnessed one of the bloodiest moments of the 20th century, and for many years, like so many veterans, he carried those memories quietly. When he finally chose to speak, he did so not for recognition, but because he believed the truth mattered, especially for future generations. All of my guests today knew Charles personally. They were close to him, worked with him, learned from him, and cared deeply for him, not just as a veteran or a symbol. Together, we'll talk about who Charles was, what he lived through, and why his voice became so important. I want to say this clearly at the beginning. Without Harold Prince and his wife, Bunny McBride, there would be no public story of Charles Shea. Harold and Bunny recognized that Charles had something important to say, and they encouraged and supported him every step of the way. Their patience, care, and commitment helped make sure his experiences were not lost to silence. Joining me for this tribute are Harold Prince and Bunny McBride. Harold Prince is a cultural anthropologist and longtime scholar of Wabanaki history. He and Bunny worked closely with Charles over many years. Bunny McBride is an award-winning author and journalist whose work has focused on Indigenous peoples around the world. They help place Charles' life story within its broader historical and moral context. They share a close personal professional relationship with Charles Shea and help bring his story to the world. Jennifer Neptune. Jennifer is a member of the Penobscot Nation, is the director of the Penobscot Nation Museum on Indian Island, a master basket maker and cultural educator. She knew Charles as an elder and carries forward his memory through her craftsmanship and storytelling. James Francis. James Francis is a member of the Penobscot Nation, serves as tribal historian and director of the Penobscot Nation Cultural and Historical Department. He worked closely with Charles and has helped preserve and share Penobscot history and memory for future generations. Timothy Shea is a nephew of Charles Norman Shea. He offers a family perspective in Charles' life, speaking to who Charles was beyond the uniform as an uncle, a relative, and deeply loved member of his family. Darren Ranko is a member of the Penobscot Nation and a scholar of Native American studies. He knew Charles as an elder and community leader and has worked to ensure that Charles' story is understood within the larger context of Indigenous service, sovereignty, and survival. The first hour is about Charles' life, his service, and the responsibility of remembering. Thank you for listening. Harold, I'm going to let you start this off. Can you talk a little bit about things that you know about Charles during the early years of his life on Indian Island?
Yes, thank you, Donna, and it's a privilege to be here with your other guests, I will let that unfold as we speak. But this is a wonderful moment of commemorating Charles, who just passed away across the ocean in Normandy, which is the place where he first landed in 1944. And that journey that he has made in his more than 101 years on this earth began in Connecticut, where his parents were working because of the high unemployment in Maine, and many Penobscot, as well as Passamaquoddy and Maliseet and Mi'kmaq, worked actually in southern New England, and so did his parents. And so Charles, his earliest years were not on the island, but then he came with his parents back when the Great Depression hit, and they came back, as a lot of other people did, because there was no work, and at least they could resort back to making baskets, the great fallback position for many people in the course of history of the Wabanaki peoples. And so his parents did that as well, and so did his aunt, Lucy, and her husband, Bruce Poulaw. So they formed, when they came back in the early 30s at Indian Island, they formed a unit that was very well experienced beyond Maine. And both Florence, his mother, her sister, Lucy, and her husband, Bruce, as well as Leo Shea, his father. And so the family had a lot of kids. One of them was, of course, Tim Shea's father, Pat. He was the tail end, I think, of the long family line. Maybe Tim can say something about that part.
I guess the thing that that comes to mind is that I kind of ran a parallel with my uncle, and I didn't spend much time on Indian Island. I left here in 1960, and I was in southern New England as well, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Connecticut. I didn't really get to know who Charles was until later on in my life, you know. So I didn't really know him too much until I came back from here, from New Mexico. I'd met him several times, but never really sat in long conversations with him over the years in my life, you know. I knew who he was. You know, I just didn't know who he, you know, in personal level. You know, and so in that sense, I kind of ran a parallel with him, because we were both away from here for so long. You know, I didn't come back here until 1977, after I got out of the military. And, you know, he was always kind of checking on me, you know, coming to different places in my life. Like, he actually went to my unit in Germany, but I had already been discharged, him and Lily. They looked me up here in Maine at one time. You know, it was kind of interesting, because I guess it was such a state of, in my infant years, that the poverty was pretty bad. And him and Lily offered to adopt me, but it never happened. I now realize that I would have grown up speaking German in Austria, and you know, it would have took me to a whole nother level of life, you know. But I traveled all over this country and went through a lot of other things, and so I don't know. It finally came back in 1977, after I left the military, after leaving here in 1960. And I stayed here a few years, and then I didn't see him until, I don't know, I think it was like around 82, you know. And then they told me what they had attempted to do in my life, you know, was to adopt me and take me as their own, you know, which really I found kind of amazing, you know, that you know, that somebody wanted to adopt me and raise me in a proper way, I guess. I don't know, because my life compared to what I would have experienced in Austria was completely different. I can say that mildly, you know. And but I went through what I went through in life, you know, and I got this far, you know. And it, when I came back from New Mexico after 20 years, I got to know him a lot better, you know, and he impressed me as a man that really liked to get things done, you know, and he didn't cut any corners, you know, and his first impression on me was he decided he wanted to take a ride down to Lincolnville Beach to visit my cousin Bobby Anderson. And we left Indian Island in his Chrysler 300 at going down that road to like Camden area and so forth, and at 80 miles an hour, you know. And I kind of looked at him, and he had Fats Domino going on the radio, on his stereo, in his car, you know. And I just kind of looked at him, and I thought, you know, this man really knows what he's doing, you know.
You better hope. I'm very familiar with those roads.
And I knew that he, you know, the man walked through two wars without a scratch, and he never fired a firearm, you know, and that he worked for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, you know, in the library, and then became a limo driver. So I got to experience his limo driving from Europe firsthand, you know, and it was pretty impressive. You know, so I knew from that this man knows what he's doing, you know, and you know, I kind of look more to him as a father figure, because he was the closest I had to my father. He was the last of my father's siblings, you know, and his upbringing, like he did live in Lincolnville area for a while. He talked about being a caddy down there in that area for the golfers, you know, and he made money that way, you know. He worked and he carried on, you know, and you know. His life was much different than most of the relatives that I knew. You know, he lived a pretty straightforward life, you know. And I often think about what my life would have been like, you know, comparatively. You know, and that's you know, to say the least, it would have been better, yeah, but then again, and the way I look at it, I had to experience what I had to experience, you know, and that's how it went. And so I don't really have any regrets in that sense, you know, but I do wonder what my life would have been like, you know. It's kind of interesting, you know. So, and I found out also with Lee Ann Francis, that was also another option for adoption with her as well, you know, and I just recently found that out, you know. So they were looking to take care of their people as best they knew how, you know. And you know, that's quite a trait, you know. I think what really impressed me about him is that he was able to go through all that and still build a good life, you know. He went through two wars, experienced a lot of stuff, you know. I mean, if you're talking about D-Day in and of itself, you know, what I saw over there when I visited was pretty overwhelming, just in the sense of trying to get my mind around all these people moving in from the ocean and taking over on that side against the Germans. You know, it was quite an impressive feat, you know. And I always and liken it to the idea how you watch ants when they're busy. That's how it felt to me, only on a human scale, you know. And you know, he went through all that, and he still managed to maintain a prominent life, you know. And I think, and then when I look at it, I felt like a lot of our veterans, you know, within the tribe, within Wabanaki people, were able to do the same thing, you know. Yeah, they had their demons from all of that, you know, from the horrors of war, but they still managed to stand upright on some level or another, you know. And I think that says a lot for our people.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely. A lot of stories, a lot of history, a lot of service. And it did help us, really. I mean, there are certain points in history where we had friends that we had developed in the military that came to help us. So that worked out. James, do you have something you want to say?
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Donna. So one thing that Charles talked with me quite a bit about was how his aunts, his mother and his aunt Lucy and his aunt Emma. Emma and Lucy were very active in a couple of things. One was ensuring there was a bridge to Indian Island at one point. But also, they were very much against the Catholic Church and really advocated for another sect of Christianity in the community. And because the Sisters of Mercy, Catholic nuns, ran the school, Charles didn't attend Indian Island School. He got on the ferry every day and matriculated in Old Town. And so that was one thing that he talked about, and it was during the summers that he would travel with his parents. I think this was before they set up the tent in Lincolnville, at Lincolnville Beach to sell baskets, because when Dr. Bill Haviland was writing his book about Deer Isle, he there was a story that Bill recollected when he was a young boy, where these Penobscot people came and they had a young boy with them. Think it was two young boys. And that ended up being Charles and with his parents. And so Bill had never met Charles. And so when Bill came to Indian Island one day, I called Charles. I says, "We got someone here who wants to visit, and he has something for you." And so we went down, and Bill presented to Charles a pack basket that he had bought from Charles's parents back in the day. And it was kind of funny because Charles was very annoyed because he thought the guy was trying to sell it to him. And but he was willing to buy it, but I could see that he was, and Bill's like, no, I don't want any money. I just want to gift it to your museum, you know, because Charles had started that family museum. But that's one thing that I think was a big part of Charles's upbringing, was this idea of these basket selling. And usually when that was taking place, the children would be performing that, dancing, and I don't know if they sang, but I know they would dance and do little performances. And that's where he obtained his name, Little Muskrat, was on that kind of very familial grounds on the road in the summertime.
On the road in the summertime, did he travel with like Lucy and Bruce? Is that?
I think originally he traveled with his parents. I think Leo and before they became kind of sedentary once they set up the tent in Lincolnville Beach. But prior to that, I'm sure they were on the road. And
That's
in fact,
interesting.
the story with Bill Haviland took place somewhere on Deer Isle, so across the bay from Lincolnville.
Interesting. I don't see Darren. There you are. What are your thoughts, Darren?
Oh, you know, I think you have on all the experts here. I'm just joining because I probably knew Charles the least out of all of you, but he was just such a. I really liked what Tim said about, a man that got things done and the way he carried himself. It was almost like, that infectious kind of being around him, like that, and I got to meet him first back. I don't even know. It must have been 20 years ago, something like that. But I think, really just here to honor him because he really did touch community, he touched individuals, and he had this, obviously larger than life, right? He had this really, and to just sit with him and have some story time is like, I had just a couple of times with him like that, and I think that's, part of why I showed up here today. And I think he connects, as James was pointing out, he connects like, he lives so long, obviously he connects us to so many ancestors and so many places across our territory and the ways in which we're connected to those places. I think there's, his family line can connect over to Norwalk. It's, it connects to these places on the coast that we almost dream about in terms of our connections and our caretaking roles. So yeah, that would be all I'd add, for now, but I think it's a really just really honored to be sharing time and space honoring Charles with you all today.
Jennifer, your comments.
Just kind of echoing what Darren said, he was really spending time with him was really inspirational, to think about all that he had lived through and experienced in his lifetime, and to be so generous with his stories and the time that he spent with all of us, meant a lot. I had an experience with him in, I think it was around 2013, where Northeast Historic Films has his home movies that he made throughout his adult lifetime, and they had asked me to write an essay about Charles and that. And so, as part of that, we sat together in his little, home on Indian Island, and we watched every single one of his home movies, and it spanned, trips that he made from Europe back to the US to visit with his parents and family here on Indian Island, trips he had made out west with Lily and his son, time in Austria and touring Europe, and just so much of his lifetime. And we sat side by side and watched all those movies. And it was like getting, like this amazing peek into what made him who he was. And, we sat there and cried together and, just watched all these people come to life that I had only seen black and white photos of, to see his mother and his father as, living people and, just come to life like that was incredibly moving. And, really, really grateful for his generosity and letting me be there and experience and relive that with him.
Bunny, I know you want to say something.
Yeah, there's so many things to say. It's wonderful to be here with everyone. And I was just thinking about how Charles had such a strong sense of commemoration and history and how much he would appreciate this gathering of people who knew him and loved him and asked him things and learned from him. And he was so devoted to his family history when he decided to renovate the teepee that his father had helped to build back in around 1950 or so, and to then have not only restore it, but to have the entire interior painted with a mural by his nephew, Calvin Francis, and really inspired by the murals he had seen in cathedrals in Europe to come and do that on Indian Island. And he was also really reclaiming the Penobscot name on that teepee. It was called Pulaw's Teepee, named for his aunt's Kiowa husband, Bruce Pulaw, and he changed it to Princess Wadawaso's, teepee and established the family museum there, and brought in the basket work of his brother Billy Shea, had Tim's work in there, had all sorts of wonderful family memorabilia, his mother's book, a little booklet on Penobscot history. So it's just wonderful to be commemorating him. Just thinking of a couple of his qualities of being, his bravery, his sense of pride of his own history and with himself. When James was talking about him going to school on the mainland, one thing story that touched me from the first time I heard it was that when he was a boy and starting when he's going to first grade on the mainland, on Sundays he would wash and iron his own clothes because he wanted to be presentable. He wanted to be respectable. And he carried that with him throughout his life. I'll never forget the first time I met him back in 97 or 98. And I was doing a story about Lucy, his aunt, and I had been talking with Charles' brother, Billy Shea, and his wife, Madeline. And they said, "Well, my brother Charles is here from Europe. He spends the summers here now. You should go talk to him about Lucy." And I went over there and to Charles' place, and he came to the door, and he was in this pressed white shirt and this tie and a tie clasp and pleated pants and two-toned shoes. And I thought, "Who is this guy?" Because I'd just come from Billy in his flannel and overalls, and that was Charles. But the bravery part of Charles, even as a boy, there's the story he told of saving his little brother Pat when they were having a great time sledding down on the east side of the island and on the falls side and propelling themselves along with ice picks. And Pat got going so fast that he went onto the ice and he went through the ice. And Charles is this short boy and he's trying to reach him and save him. And another Penobscot boy, Harry Hamilton, came over, was walking across the river from Milford, and he saw Charles, and he came and grabbed Charles' ankles so he could push him out as he was lying on his belly closer to his brother, and they retrieved Pat. And that's why we have Tim here today. They retrieved Pat and brought him home so he could lead his life and carry forward. I'll just say one other story, because it became so much a part of his life, these performances that he did in Europe. Indeed, they started, as others have already said, with performing with Lucy and Bruce and also with his mother. But as a teenager in 1941, at a big old town celebration of its incorporation, the Lucy was invited to organize a giant 3-day pageant that the Penobscots did at Victory Field in Old Town. And Charles and talked about how he and a lot of other young men, they performed as warriors in the reenactment of the massacre of at the Mission Village on at Norwich Walk. And this was a remarkable piece of political theater that really put in the face of the community what had happened to Penobscot ancestors in 1724 at that massacre. When Harold can give probably offer the details of numbers, but it was a horrific massacre where there were 14 scalps of children taken. There were 7 of women, and then there were 5 of men, including Father Relais. And Charles participated in that. He learned early the value of public performance.
Harold.
Thank you, Donna. Thank you, everyone else. It's fascinating to hear these different stories that shed light on this remarkable man who just passed away and whom we are now commemorating in this Wabanaki Windows radio show. And I'm really thankful to Donna for having organized this and got us all together here. Yes, what's fascinating about the massacre at Norwich Rock, 1724, that of course that pageant took place just before Pearl Harbor, several months before Pearl Harbor, when America became involved in a war that was already going on by that time for almost 2 years. It started in Europe in 1939 with the Nazi German invasion of Poland. And by that time, the American army began to build up. So people like Melvin Neptune was already in the Big Red One, the 1st Division, as was Madeleine Shay's brother, was also in the Big Red One. They were already in military service at that time, training in Panama, and then later went to England. And they then Pius died, but Melvin then went off to help fight the Germans in North Africa. So one of the remarkable things about that pageant, that commemorated the massacre, that just before the American army became militarily involved in fighting both the Japanese and the Germans, as well as the Italians, the axis of fascist nations. That at that time, a number of Penobscot had already volunteered to be in the military. Later, of course, many were drafted. And so Bunny was mentioning the political theater, but Florence, who's often forgotten in terms of her activism because she was so busy also as a mother of many, many children, and I don't know how she found the time to do it all, but she began to agitate against the draft because she felt a little bit like the slogan from the American Revolutionary War period, no taxation without representation. She felt that without representation, Penobscots and other Wabanaki should not have to fight in the American military. If they did so voluntarily or for patriotic or financial reasons, this was one thing, but to be forced into it would be another. So she protested against the draft, not out of lack of patriotism, because she felt extraordinarily patriotic. Many Penobscots felt very patriotic and still do, but she was against the forced service in the military. And I'm sure that James can talk more about that.
Hey, James, you're on.
So his or I know little about that, and I appreciate your confidence in my knowledge about his very early service. I do know they were living in Dexter at the time, and that it was important for him to serve. And there's one story that comes to mind, because as I think it was one of the very first campaigns that Charles was on was D-Day. It was very early on in his service. The meeting up the night before with Melvin Neptune, that was something that Charles talked about a lot, because it was a little piece of home that Charles kind of grabbed a hold of in that moment. A lot of chaos, a lot of the unknown, and then you're staring at one of your childhood friends in that strange place, in that strange situation. And he carried that with him, across the channel, and that little piece of home helped him to, harness that connection to the community during the invasion on D-Day, and sending those prayers back home to his mother, and the prayers that returned from his mother. And but his service was something that he did unapologetically. It was just who he was. And I just wanted to touch a little bit about like respectable that Bunny was talking about, and how put together and how refined he was. He was, he's the only man I've known to put on driving gloves to go get the daily newspaper. He'd get in his car and he'd put his driving gloves on. And when he got that sporty Camaro, he ordered the jacket. There's a white jacket that he wears and that went with the car. And he always looked just so sharp. And he had a friend come in from France once, and he had always asked me to do a private history presentation for his guests. And so I was doing this private history presentation one morning, and it got to be lunchtime, and this is when he still had his Chrysler 300, and he asked me to go to lunch. Because, hey, you want to go to lunch with us? We're gonna, go get some lunch. And he goes, here, why don't you drive? And he tosses me the keys, and then he proceeds to get in the back seat with his guest. So now, like, I'm the chauffeur. So we, but that was definitely Charles. I was like, all right. I says, my name is James, so I will take that role. Yeah, but as far as following what Harold suggested, yeah, that's what I have to share.
Okay. Harold, what were you thinking when you asked James that?
One of the things, picking up on what James was just mentioning about this mysterious meeting by Melvin, who came aboard the Henry Code, which was the troopship that crossed the channel in the night of the 5th to the 6th of June during storm. Charles had never any idea where Melvin came from, but he was serving in the 26th regiment of the 1st Division, the Big Red One. And he had already fought in North Africa and had also fought in Sicily, had been wounded, got the Purple Heart. And he landed as a scout, a forward observer for the one of the other regiment that he served in the Big Red One on the eastern side of Omaha Beach. And while Charles was rightfully awarded the Silver Star for heroism, in particular on that morning, that later afternoon, early evening, Melvin stormed a machine gun nest and was awarded for that the Bronze Star. And those memories of many Penobscot, but also Maliseet Mi'kmaq, as well as Passamaquoddy, have been forgotten. I just would like to take the time here to commemorate, although Charles didn't know that at the time, but a Passamaquoddy machine gunner aboard one of the bombing planes had just been killed. Passamaquoddy had just been killed after a raid on Germany about a month before Charles crossed the channel. Afterwards, many other Penobscot, Passamaquoddy, and Swords also landed. But on D-Day itself, the uncle of one of the well-known Passamaquoddy, his name was Philip Neptune, or Neptin, you spelled his name. He was also a medic, but he was with the 29th Division, and he was killed about 9 days after the landing in Normandy. Most people have forgotten his name, but there were sacrifices being made, not only on Omaha and the hinterland, but just to segue briefly to a Maliseet by the name of Jim Thoma. Jim Thoma landed on Juno Beach on D-Day morning as a infantry soldier in an assault platoon with the North Shore Regiment, the Canadian regiment that was one of the spearheading infantry units that landed on the Canadian landing beach, which is just east of Omaha Beach. And Jim Thoma was later wounded in the Battle of Caen. Was recovered in the hospital, went back into combat, and then was part of the liberation of the Netherlands. And I found out about that in 1982 when Jim was a basket maker. Later, he became the chief of the Houlton Band of Maliseet, but he was a basket maker. And I entered his work shack, and he looked at me after my third or fourth visit. He smiled kind of faintly. And he said, Godverdomme, where is het bier? And I looked at him and I thought, that's not Maliseet. What the hell is he saying? And I realized at one point that it was Dutch. And I asked him, Jim, do you know my language? And he said, yes, one sentence, God damn it, where's the beer? And it turned out he had been shell-shocked in the Netherlands and ended up on a farm. Anyway, I wrote that story down, but I never published it. But when Charles first mentioned in 2004 that he had wanted to be part of the commemoration of the D-Day landings, the 60th anniversary of the D-Day landings in 2004, and Bunny and I had taken him out for a lobster roll in Bangor at the restaurant on the riverside. And I said, you were there? And he said, yes. And then I paused and I asked Oma, and he said, yes. And then I didn't ask any further, but of course I realized very well what that meant. And I didn't know why he had never mentioned it, but I immediately thought about Jim Thoma, who had never also talked about it. And even to this day, his name is forgotten. But that led to, with Jim Thoma in my mind, a forgotten hero who had sacrificed, and no one had ever asked him about it until I stepped into that shack, his basket making shack. I thought, if there's one person to bring that story to light of Wabanaki sacrifices in World War II, Charles Story could do it. And I said that to him. I said, Charles, your story is important because most Americans will only remember two battles from World War II. One is Iwo Jima for the Pacific, and Omaha for the European theater. And D-Day is the moment that everybody knows because of the film Saving Private Ryan that had come out in 1998. And Charles agreed that his story would make history in the sense, not just for himself, but also for all the other Wabanaki whose sacrifices had been ignored, forgotten, not commemorated.
Yeah, maybe it's worth mentioning here that one of the speeches that he gave, where he actually read a whole list of, forgotten names, native names, in a very
Donna was very important to that. Donna, because you helped establish Native American Veterans Day when you were in the tribal legislature.
Well, Donald Sauk Thoma had more to do with that than I did. But yeah, I was there and I was a co-sponsor.
So I just want to interject here because of how all of that went down was kind of funny. I was I think it was I was bringing him his daily newspaper. Sometimes he'd ask me to go and grab him the paper. He always read the paper. He had showed me that he the John Baldacci's office wanted to have a proclamation of a Charles Shay Day in the state of Maine. And he goes, I don't want it. I says, you don't want it? He goes, no, it isn't. It's not about me. And I said, okay. I said, would you? Well, this is really unorthodox. He goes, I'd take it on behalf of all Wabanaki veterans. So I said, okay. So I end up calling, it was Jack Cashman's boy, who was then the press secretary for John Baldacci. So I called him, Danny Cashman. And I was like, yeah, he doesn't want a Charles Shay Day. And he got really quiet. He goes, this is highly unusual. I don't think anybody's ever declined. I says, but he will accept it on behalf of all Wabanaki veterans. And so that they said, okay, we can make that change. And so they did all that. And during that ceremony, and I think most of us here were there at that ceremony, Charles was shaking hands with John Baldacci, and Charles said, this should happen every year. And John Baldacci said, yeah, it should. And it was like just privately as they were shaking hands. And Charles really held him to that, yeah, it should. And that's how the kind of the annual Wabanaki Veterans Day came about. Charles was very persistent in making sure that happened.
Well, he certainly did like to get things done, that's for sure. I think that he also, wasn't there some talk about building a library or for some reason that comes to mind, or maybe it was the museum, I don't know. But he wanted to preserve the history, yeah.
I was just going to say, at one point, he was hoping that his property would become an archives for the Penobscot Nation, and I don't. There were probably issues of, the security of the air quality of all the things that a normal archives would have to have that little old Sears Roebuck house didn't have. But he did have that idea at one point.
Yeah, I thought so, and also I think that's why he was trying to preserve some of the books and the stories. There were one that he helped with writing.
There were a couple that he
Yeah.
so there was a chapter in a book about his aunt Lucy, Princess Wadawaso. And so it happened to be a chapter I wrote. And so he wanted to do an off print of that, a booklet just about Lucy. And so I gave him the copyrights, and then he went to the printer. He worked to have that be done. And then he did another one about his mother. And then he also did the foreword for a new edition of his grandfather's book, The Life and Traditions of the Red Man, and wrote the foreword for that. So he was really active in getting things done, as everybody has said here. You know, this is a man who built his own house in Vienna from the ground up. So he knew how to use his hands, and he had ideas, just like he did with the mural in the teepee, where, you know, Calvin talks about how he would do his day job and then go over to the teepee at 9 o'clock at night. And from 9 to 2 a.m., he would, you know, work on the mural. Sounds like the Sistine Chapel to me. I mean, it was just this endless work. And then when he worked during the weekends, Charles would always come and say, "Lunch is ready," and would have lunch ready for him. Not just because Charles is a good host, but because he didn't want Calvin going off and taking a break somewhere else. He wanted to be sure he got back out there working on that. I hope we won't pass without Jennifer telling about the collar.
That was my next move. Go ahead,
Right.
Jennifer. Tell us about how that happened.
Yeah, the collar, the way that came about was pretty magical. And James and Tim were involved with that. I believe Tim was the one that found the photograph, the old photograph of Charles's mother wearing the collar. And then Charles took it to James to, repair the tear in it digitally. And James, from staring at it so long, was like, "I know that collar," and recognized it as being one in the collections of the National Museum of the American Indian. And Charles, was like, "I want that collar." And James was like, "Well, they're probably not going to give it back to you, and it's, probably old and damaged, and why don't you go talk to Jennifer? She's a bead worker, and maybe she could make you one." And so Charles came and talked to me, and that set that in motion. And before I knew it, I was at the Museum of the American Indian, all nervous going in to see this collar in person that Charles's mother had worn, that had probably been passed down through Charles's family. And all I had ever seen was that photograph in black and white. And so to see it in color in all its beauty and glory was amazing, to see all the stitches that were made to try to figure out how I was going to make it for Charles was really special. And that day too, as I was leaving, this butterfly came and, was like all around me. And I found out it was Charles's mother's birthday that day. So it was all very magical and meant to be. So while I was working on the collar, Charles being Charles would visit me almost weekly and he would say, "How is the collar going? You know, is it close?" And I'm like, "No, this takes a lot of time. Like, be patient." And he'd be like, "You know, I'm old. I'm old." But it took me like 3 years to finish the collar. And it was made with a lot of love for Charles, a lot of prayers for him and his family and, you know, our tribe and our nation. And I think, you know, Charles loved history and he loved our culture and he loved Indian Island and all the people there. And so when I was making it, I was putting that love into it as well. And, you know, so glad to be part of Charles's life in that way and creating something for him that he wore and was meaningful to him. Yeah, I
And
don't know.
so where's the
And
caller now?
so as far as I know, the collar's still in France. I didn't quite dare ask what was going to happen to the collar now that Charles is gone. I don't know. Like the collar, I made it with love for him and, you know, let it go when I handed it over and put it on his shoulders. And so that collar's on its own journey, representing him and Penobscot Nation. And we'll see where it ends up, if it ever comes home or where it resurfaces. It's on its own journey now.
Yeah, I just wanted to just touch on, in Charles Schee fashion, there was a press kind of release about when, this when Jennifer was going to reveal the collar to him. And so we all met in the tribal council chambers, and there was something that I wasn't expecting, because one, it just radiated this energy and beauty, this brand new. And I've seen dozens of these collars in dozens of museums, and the what really hit me was, and I realized in that moment that I had never seen somebody getting one put on them. And this like wave of energy just went through the room when Jennifer placed that on Charles's shoulders, and it was like the hairs on the back of my neck. It was just so meaningful and powerful, and then to have the honor of putting it on him in Normandy. I think it was on the anniversary of at Normandy. It was a few years back, but there was a call for somebody to put it on him, and I think Marie had somebody else in mind, and I said, "No, a Penobscot's going to put that collar on him." And so I went up on stage and put the collar on him. I hope it comes home.
I'd like to add a little bit to the history of how that collar came to be, you know. And it's a very beautiful piece. Thank you, Jennifer, for taking that on and sacrificing 3 years of your life, you know. The photograph that collar is in, I was living in the old house my grandparents owned over there on I guess it's now kind of pretty dilapidated, but there was a garage in the back, and I went in there and I opened it up. It hadn't been opened up in quite a while. It was around 82, 83, and I found this old trunk, and I opened it, and that's where I found that photograph. And I carried that photograph with me for quite some years, you know. And I knew it was my grandmother, and so when I came back in 2004, I had also acquired one of the original copies of Life and Traditions of the Red Man. It was a hard copy book, and I passed them on to Uncle Charlie, you know, and it kind of inspired him to really move with that, And then, of course, James, he recognized that, and the story went on where, Jennifer recreated it, and then the book was redone again. This was like, I think, the second or third attempt to recreate that book, so what I kind of see in there is that he was inspired by his parents, and Lucy to promote his people, and he saw that opportunity and he took a hold of it, I think that it really says a lot about him as a Penobscot man, period, and then of course the whole rebuilding of the teepee and everything, it was just like it just moved him, and I kind of wonder, what, how far he traveled and how much he did and everything that he went through, and then to come back in his later years and do what he'd done, where did it all come from, and in one sense, I feel like it's my grandmother's spirit, it's Lucy's spirit, it's his father's spirit, they nudged him somehow, and it's pretty moving, really, when you look at the whole picture, of how it all evolved. And I don't think that the spirit that lives in that collar that is existing right now, I don't think it's going to stay there very long. It's going to come back, it's destined to be here. I don't think that anybody else can hold on to it and be in good conscience, so.
Tim, Charles asked you to make beautiful sculptures that were in his garden as well as in his house. But could you talk about when you started working on the turtle monument in Normandy, and then later the one at Indian Island that faces each other? They face each other.
I was quite taken back when that came about, to make that one in France. I didn't see it coming, by any means. I was approached by, Uncle Charlie and Marie and all of it, and it was like, okay, I'll do it, and how could I not do it, So I went over there and I lived there. I was living there for 6 weeks. And, I wasn't going to try to transport a main rock over there. That was one thing that was out of the picture. And so I asked about the stones in France, and we found this blue stone that comes from France. It's a granite. It's a very beautiful stone. He also had this vest that my ex-wife, who's passed on now, but she made this vest for him with a turtle on the back. I think it kind of got inspired from there, and that's where the idea of a turtle altogether came about.
As we close the first hour, I want to thank my guests for their generosity and honesty in sharing their memories of Charles Norman Shea. Charles survived one of the most violent moments of the 20th century, but what defined him was how he lived afterward, with humility, compassion, and a deep sense of responsibility to teach. When we return for our second hour, we will speak about Charles' connection to France, his final days, and the legacy he leaves in the hands of those who loved him. This is Wabanaki Windows. I'm Donna Loring.